This is the age of discovery and conquest. Episode 1. The Vikings Discover America. So, who really discovered America? Whenever I get into a discussion about the age of discovery, someone always raises the question, if the Indians were here first, why do we say that Columbus discovered America? Shouldn't the Indians get the credit? Other people raise a similar objection by pointing out that the Vikings, or really a better term, the Norse, arrived in North America 500 years before Columbus did. So, who really discovered America? I think when we quibble over this, we lose sight of the bigger picture. The Indians were certainly in the Americas for thousands of years before Columbus arrived in the New World. And it's also true that the Norse arrived in North America about 500 years before Columbus. I'm not going to split hairs in some silly semantic argument over what the word discovery means. Rather than waste time going down that road, I think there's a better way to approach this subject. If we look back to prehistoric times, anthropologists tell us that Homo sapiens have their origin in Africa and have been living on planet Earth for about 200,000 years. For a good long time, our ancestors were content to dwell in the tropics, but at some point, these early humans began to move. It's open to speculation as to why, but the reason probably has to do with their need to find basic resources, like food. Keep in mind that we humans are by nature omnivores, and most of us crave both meat protein and plant-based carbohydrates in our diet. That being the case, our prehistoric ancestors embarked upon millennia of nomadic hunting and gathering, fracturing into new groups and then moving off in all directions in search of a steady supply of food. At some point about 80,000 years ago, small groups of nomads left Africa and migrated into Asia. Somewhere along the route, groups of humans splintered off and doubled back towards the northwest, eventually entering Europe. Over the course of many thousands of years, these nomadic hunters and gatherers fanned out across the Eurasian landmass and even crossed the sea to populate Australia. Now, those people who were poised to cross Beringia, that's what we call that land bridge that once connected Siberia and Alaska. Those people arrived in Beringia about 40,000 years ago, towards the tail end of the last ice age. At that time, giant sheets of ice stretched down from the polar region and blocked any advance these nomads might make into North America. However, as the Earth's climate continued to warm and the ice sheets melted, the way into North America that was once blocked now lay open. And between 16,000 and 13,000 years ago, the nomadic hunters entered the Americas, spreading south and east by various routes. Now, I don't think it's correct to label these nomadic wanderings as missions of discovery. I think a better description of what was happening here is something that historians and anthropologists call divergence. If you think about it, this whole story of nomadic migration is a story of people moving away from one another, ultimately to the most far-flung reaches of six continents. Now, I say six continents because, so far, no one has found any evidence of prehistoric humans migrating all the way to Antarctica. It seems the furthest south the people got was to Tierra del Fuego, at the southern tip of South America. To come back to the question we started this episode with, about whether Columbus or the Indians deserve the credit for discovering America, if we look at what went on before 1492, we can't help but realize that everything up to that point qualifies, really, as part of this divergence I just mentioned. Something different, though, began happening after 1492. Whether you call it discovery or not, Columbus's voyage to the New World marked the beginning of convergence, or to put it another way, people were now coming together. For better or for worse, the consequence of Columbus's voyage in 1492 has been that for the last 500 years or so, the most far-flung and isolated human communities have been drawn together into a global nexus of convergence. Is this convergence phenomenon a good thing? Or has convergence been the cause of incalculable human misery? I'll leave it to you to pass your own judgment on that. What I can say with certainty is that 1492 marks a turning point for mankind, and we've been living with the consequences of the great Columbian convergence ever since. But where do the Vikings fit into all of this? If discovery of the New World began the process of convergence, shouldn't we then mark its beginning at that moment when the Vikings made landfall somewhere in the Atlantic provinces of Canada? I would have to say no. Although the Vikings beat Columbus to America by 500 years, their discovery did not mark the beginning of the great global convergence. Instead, if examined critically, we see that the Viking migration to North America was actually the final and furthest extent of the last great divergent migration. Coincidentally, the Vikings weren't the only people participating in this final divergence around the turn of the first millennium. Like the Vikings, the Inuit were also pushing toward the furthest limits of human divergence, but the Inuit were coming from the other direction, migrating across the North American Arctic toward the east. Although both the Vikings and the Inuit would run into one another in Greenland, their contact never resulted in the world-changing vortex of convergence that really only begins after 1492. So, what we must examine now is the Viking discovery of America, but in the context of it being the last chapter in that final stage of human divergence before the voyages of Columbus reverses the trend. Now, if you're interested in taking a look at some maps to help you visualize what I'm talking about, you can visit my webpage at georgemonahan.com. If you follow the link to the podcast section, you'll find not just maps, but I've also put up a short list of books you might want to read if you're interested in learning more about the topics I cover in this and in upcoming episodes. So, we turn our attention now to the Viking discovery of America. But before we can go any further, we need to clarify some of the terminology we'll be using. To begin with, the term Viking is not entirely accurate when talking about those Scandinavian people who first set foot in the New World. A better way to describe these people would be to call them the Norse, meaning people from the north. In that region we associate with the modern-day countries of Norway, Denmark, and Sweden. Although the terms Norse and Viking are often used interchangeably, the word Viking really only applies to those Norse who ventured out on seaborne raids of pillage and plunder. To go a Viking, as they would say, using the word Viking as a verb. The target of these raids were often other people in Scandinavia, but the Vikings seemed to turn up everywhere in Europe between the 8th and the 11th centuries, and in most places they were associated with lurid and gruesome stories of violence. Some scholars have observed that the medieval Norse get a bum rap because of this mistaken idea that every Norseman was a marauding Viking. This is not the case at all. In fact, most people in Scandinavia followed more peaceful occupations, such as farming and shepherding. On top of that, those few Norsemen who turned to pillage and plunder usually only did so on a temporary basis. Young men would leave the family farm and sign on with some local chieftain for a season of seaborne raiding. If the score was big, these seasonal marauders would divvy up the loot and return home rich. Sometimes, and this was definitely the case with the Vikings that plundered Britain and Ireland, these Norsemen would set up bases of operation in the lands they pillaged. These bases, which started out as nothing more than armed camps, soon grew into thriving towns that attracted more Norse settlers. Eventually, the Viking raids subsided, giving way to commerce between the Norse townsmen and the locals they were now living amongst. Scandinavian merchants were soon plying the waters around Europe, buying and selling cargoes in seaports that stretched from the Mediterranean to the Baltic Sea, and all along the Atlantic coast from Lapland to the Straits of Gibraltar. Now, that's not to say that the violence suddenly ended, or that the Norse somehow transformed into libertarian free marketeers. Slavery played a big role in the Viking Age, and many people who were enslaved were exploited not just for their labor, but in the case of abducted women, many were used to satisfy the sexual desires of their captors. Now, keep in mind also that the Norse during this age were still, for the most part, pagans and devotees of their ancestral gods, such as Odin and Thor. Although Christianity was beginning to win over a few converts among the Norse, The Vikings were as yet untempered by any moral restraint or code of chivalry that protected non-combatants from their fury. In any event, the plunder and rapine of the early Viking Age was giving way to settlement and commerce, and Norse settlements began springing up outside Scandinavia, most notably in the British Isles. Now, keep in mind that many of these Norse settlers had been shepherds back in Scandinavia, and pasture land for livestock was a resource they highly valued. When they arrived in places like Britain and Ireland, the Norse definitely took over the best grazing land, but their desire to obtain more pasture land for their livestock was never fully satisfied. Now, we have no record of exactly how or when this happened, but it must have been sometime after the Norse began settling in Ireland that they heard from the locals about uninhabited islands out across the ocean. These were lush, grass-covered islands, the Irish said, that could sustain large herds of livestock. And since there was nobody living on these islands, the Irish said the Norse could settle them with little effort. All the Norse needed to do now was locate them, and the Irish most likely provided them with detailed sailing directions. But hold on. You're probably asking yourself the same question the Vikings did. How did the Irish know about these uninhabited islands further out in the Atlantic? Well, to answer this, we need to backtrack a few centuries and talk a little bit about the peculiarities of the Irish and the religion they followed. During the late Roman Empire, Christianity had been an illegal, underground religion, and its adherents were subject to some horrendous punishments if they ever got caught. However, all this changed when the Emperor Constantine legalized Christianity in 313 AD. Remarkably, within two generations, Christianity was not only legalized, but it became the official religion of the Roman Empire under Emperor Theodosius around 380 AD. Within the empire, Christianity was primarily an urban-based religion, with the major centers of worship located in large towns and cities. Ireland, however, was outside the empire, since it had never been conquered by the Romans. As a result, the Irish not only held on to their pagan beliefs longer than the Romans, but the Irish also never developed an urbanized, town-centered society like those parts of Europe under Roman rule. Now, of course, there are towns and cities in Ireland today, but these had their origin as Norse settlements in the 9th and 10th centuries. The evidence suggests that the Christian gospel was first preached in Ireland about the year 400 by missionaries from Roman Britain. However, the full-scale conversion of the Irish people really began in the mid-5th century as the result of the missionary activity of St. Patrick. Now, at first glance, Patrick's mission might seem like a tremendous success, but his efforts were unsuccessful in at least one regard. Although Patrick was a skilled evangelist, as a Roman Christian, part of his mission involved planting a church organization in Ireland that was based on the Roman model, where bishops supervised the faithful from urban-based cathedrals. The Irish accepted Christianity, but in spite of Patrick's mission, they remained semi-nomadic rustics, without towns and cities, and therefore without that Roman organizational model that Patrick sought to institute. The Roman church model would eventually come to Ireland, but only as a consequence of the Norman conquest in the late 12th century. In the meantime, the Irish developed a national church with certain quirky peculiarities. In an age when the Irish were still semi-nomadic and tribal, people owed their loyalty to clan chieftains and regional kings. This didn't stop Christianity from taking firm root, but as we said, it did prevent the establishment of an urban-based church patterned on the Roman model. In spite of Patrick's best efforts in this regard, the Irish created something different. This wasn't because the Irish were intentionally opposing Patrick's efforts. It's just that the Irish found it more natural to adapt the church's administrative system to their own clannish, non-urbanized ways. What emerged in Ireland was a church organized around regional monasteries, supervised not by bishops, but by abbots who governed these monastic communities like tribal chieftains. The Irish embraced the same doctrine as the Roman church, but when it came to managing church affairs, the Irish did things their own way. This pragmatic arrangement led to the development of a peculiar type of spirituality among the Irish. In this rustic world on the fringe of European civilization, The extended family, or clan, was an institution that provided security and a sense of belonging for most people. This was certainly the case in pagan times, and it was no less so after the Irish became Christians. In many ways, the monastic community served as the extension of the clan into Christian times. Separation from the clan, for whatever reason, was considered not just a hardship, but a dangerous descent into a world of anarchistic peril, fraught with nightmarish dangers. Separated from the clan, a wayfarer might fall victim to the savagery of outlaws, brigands, and pirates. And in a world where rival clans often feuded, there was always the possibility that a lone traveler might cross paths with one's enemies. Simply put, this was a culture where people avoided venturing too far away from the group. Now, we know that this attitude was not uniquely Irish. The evidence shows that people in other cultures also feared the perils associated with wayfaring. In fact, if you look up the word travel in the dictionary, you'll see it comes into our language from the French word travail, which means painful anguish or hardship. For this reason, it's easy to understand why banishment was imposed as a punishment for serious crimes in the Middle Ages. Banishment could last for a prolonged period, or in some cases, for the rest of the offender's life. This being the case, one might ask, why would anyone willingly cut himself off from the care and security that membership in a community provides? Yet, as much as people feared the isolation and danger associated with travel, many Irish Christians actually chose to enter into voluntary exile. Why? The answer has to do with a form of spirituality known as asceticism. Asceticism is not unique to Irish Christianity, nor to Christianity in general, and we can find some variant of its practice in many of the world's religions. So, what exactly does asceticism entail? Well, in order to achieve a deeper spiritual life, the ascetic seeks detachment from worldly pleasures by practicing disciplined self-denial. In more extreme cases, ascetics have been known to deliberately inflict pain and prolonged physical suffering on one's own body. Now, among the Irish, ascetic practice could be so extreme that it's difficult to find devotees from other Christian traditions who could outmatch them in acts of self-denial and physical abasement. One of the more extreme ascetic practices was the voluntary removal of oneself from the community. While away, the ascetic might embark on a pilgrimage to any number of religious shrines located across Europe and in the Holy Land. In many instances, these pilgrimages involve withdrawal to some remote, nearly inaccessible place so that the ascetic could spend the remainder of his days in prayer and meditation. In some instances, ascetics intent on finding solitude actually inspired other ascetics to follow them, ultimately resulting in the foundation of new monastic communities. The most famous of these spiritual trailblazers was Saint Columba, who founded a monastery on the island of Iona off the west coast of Scotland in 563. Many other monasteries and chapels were founded in this way throughout the British Isles by Irish monks who originally went looking for a remote place where they could be alone with God. Some Irish monks pushed their asceticism to the limit, and by far the most radical of these were those who sought solitude on the open ocean. Trusting in God's loving care, sometimes alone and sometimes in small groups, these monks sailed far off into the ocean in a type of boat called a curragh, the hull of which was made of animal skins stretched over a wooden frame. With no particular destination in mind, some monks made landfall on previously unknown islands in the North Atlantic. Occasionally, though, an ascetic might return to Ireland. However, many who sought solitude in the open ocean were lost at sea and left no record of their ultimate fate. In one instance, this peculiarly Irish practice of seaborne asceticism gave rise to a popular folktale known as the Voyage of St. Brendan. The protagonist of this tale, Brendan of Clonfert, was also known as St. Brendan the Navigator and was a real-life contemporary of St. Columba, who we just mentioned as the founder of the monastery at Iona. St. Brendan died around the year 577, But sometime during his life, he was said to have made one of these seaborne retreats in the company of a small group of monks, and to have visited a number of marvelous islands somewhere across the Atlantic Ocean. This story was transmitted orally for a few hundred years before it was committed to writing in the 9th century, and it has come down to us in a text titled The Voyage of St. Brendan the Navigator. Now, there are a lot of people out there, especially among those of Irish descent, who try to press the claim that the marvelous islands mentioned in this story are actually in North America, and that the voyage of St. Brendan should be accepted as historical proof that the Irish were the first Europeans to have visited the New World. With a name like Monaghan, you might think I'd be among these St. Brendan enthusiasts, but you'd be wrong. I don't buy any of this. The story in the voyage of St. Brendan is not history. While the core of the story might contain a kernel of truth, the voyage of St. Brendan is really a Christianized version of very popular pagan Irish folktales involving heroic sea voyages to otherworldly places. The written versions of the Brendan story seem to conflate a lot of these folkloric elements, but they might also allude to real islands discovered by other Irish monks who sought solitude in the Atlantic. I believe the real St. Brendan may very well have visited previously unknown islands during his travels, but I don't believe he made it all the way to America. But as the Irish say, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. The story of St. Brendan remained immensely popular into the later Middle Ages, and as we'll see in an upcoming episode, yarns spun by old salts of having spotted Brendan's Isle proved inspirational to both Christopher Columbus and also to the explorers that set out from the English port of Bristol in the late 15th century. Remember, it was in a ship crewed by sailors from Bristol that John Cabot discovered Newfoundland in 1497. As I said, we'll have more to say about the St. Brendan legend and the Bristol explorers in an upcoming episode. But we should turn our attention now to the real Irish discoveries in the Atlantic. Although the Hebrides Islands were frequently visited by Irish monks, their proximity between Scotland and Ireland meant that sailors knew of their existence for as long as anyone could remember. Venturesome Irish monks also began sailing to the more remote and less well-known Orkney and Shetland Islands by the mid-6th century. As their reach widened, in about the year 700, Irish monks made landfall on the previously unknown Faroe Islands. And shortly afterwards, they sighted Iceland. Less than a century later, in the year 795, Irish monks landed in Iceland and built shelters where they could spend time in prayer. Here again, to visualize all this, you might find it helpful to refer to a map. Feel free to visit my webpage at georgemonaghan.com and follow the link to the podcast section. Here you'll find maps and other reference material that pertain to the Age of Discovery. Well, in any event, neither the Faroe Islands nor Iceland were truly colonized by the Irish, but the few monks who went out there to pray built rude houses and small chapels for themselves. In the case of the Faroe Islands, the Irish monks even went so far as to bring along some sheep so they might make use of their milk. True colonization doesn't begin in the Faroes nor in Iceland until the arrival there of the Norse during the Viking Age. The event that kicked off the Viking Age in 793 was the Norse sacking of Lindisfarne, a monastery in northern England founded by the Irish monk St. Aidan. The Viking marauders learned that undefended monasteries made great targets and were usually loaded with valuable religious articles fashioned of gold and silver. Attracted by the promise of easy plunder, the Vikings raided both the larger monasteries and the small chapels they found scattered across the Shetlands, the Orkneys, and the Hebrides, as well as in Great Britain and Ireland proper. As stated earlier, we have no exact evidence about how it happened or who it was that spilled the beans, but the Vikings probably learned about the existence of both the Faroe Islands and Iceland from Irish monks. When the Norse sailed to the Faroe Islands, they didn't find any people there, but they did find the herds of sheep that the monks had brought there. In Iceland, the Vikings did find a handful of Irish monks along the southern coast, but otherwise the island was uninhabited. About the year 800, the Norse settlement of the Faroe Islands began, and by 874, the colonization of Iceland was underway. One of the reasons the Norse were so successful during the Viking Age was because of their advanced shipbuilding technology. Having learned how to forge iron, the Norse made good use of the metal, not just for weapons, but also to fashion woodworking tools. With iron implements such as axes and planing tools, the Norse were able to fell trees and cut planks from which they constructed sturdy wooden ships. Hundreds of years before the Viking Age began, the Norse learned the rudiments of navigation and seamanship during fishing expeditions and through coastal trade. Up to this point, the Norse made use of oars to propel their watercraft, and since this took a lot of effort, the ancestors of the Vikings tended to stick close to the shore. However, everything changed when sails and sail rigging technology was introduced from the Mediterranean. About the same time, the Norse began using iron nails and rivets to fasten the wooden planks of their ships, making their sea craft stronger and more seaworthy than before. Now, having harnessed the wind, the Norse were able to sail over vast stretches of ocean in sturdy, seaworthy ships capable of carrying large numbers of armed men and tons of cargo. Without such ships, the Norse colonization of the Faroes and Iceland would not have been possible. If you were to ask most people to conjure in their minds the image of a typical Norse sailing vessel, they would probably visualize the sleek, symmetrically proud Viking longship, replete with a menacing dragon figurehead, a large square sail, and with round shields braced along the gunwales. The Vikings did indeed use the famed longship for fighting at sea and for carrying men on pillaging expeditions around Europe and the British Isles. But the primary Norse ship used for hauling cargo and to transport people to the new settlements in the North Atlantic was a type of ship called the Knurr. These ships were generally a little over 50 feet in length and about 15 feet wide, with a cargo capacity of up to 24 tons. Like the longship, the Knurr was primarily a sailing vessel. They did carry oars, but these ships were not easy to maneuver in this way, so more often than not, their chief means of propulsion was wind power. They were similar to the longship also in that they had no cabin or below-deck area, but it was possible to rig up on deck something like an awning or tent made out of cowhide, where passengers and crew could take shelter from the elements. Because of their large carrying capacity and sturdy, seaworthy design, these ships had great range and made possible the settlement of the Faroe Islands and Iceland, and as we shall see, also Greenland. And from Greenland, even though the attempt proved unsuccessful, these Knurrn, to use the plural form, made Norse exploration and settlement expeditions possible to places as far away as the maritime provinces of Canada. But before we talk about the Norse in Canada, we need to place them firmly in the North Atlantic, first in Iceland and then in Greenland. For as seaworthy as the Knurrn were, it is unlikely that the Norse would have sailed these ships from their Scandinavian homeland all the way to North America, since they had no idea that America existed. Remember, these were practical people who were lured to the Western Atlantic by Irish reports of grassy islands where livestock might thrive. As remote as the Faroes and Iceland might seem, the Norse settlers there kept in contact with Scandinavia and the British Isles as merchant ships carrying cargoes and people made the trip back and forth with increasing frequency. The lure of economic prosperity in Iceland was compelling, and Norse shipping traffic in the Atlantic grew to meet the demand. But the weather in the North Atlantic was not always agreeable. Conditions could worsen rapidly, and visibility would deteriorate to the point where it became impossible to discern in which direction your ship was going. Now keep in mind, the compass hadn't been invented yet. While at sea, Norse sailors occasionally became disoriented, becalmed, and adrift in fog banks that hung low for weeks on end. The old Norse sagas have a wonderfully ominous word to describe this state of disorientation at sea. It's called Hafvila. It was in conditions just like these that Norse sailors overshot Iceland and accidentally discovered Greenland. Soon, the Icelandic Norse established a settlement in Greenland, and the process repeated itself. This time, Icelandic sailors bound for Greenland became disoriented and overshot their intended destination. And when the weather lifted, a previously unknown coast hove into view. Within a few years, a small group of Greenland Norse returned and attempted to settle what we now know to be the Maritime Provinces of Canada. So, that's the overview. But before we go into the details of how the Norse arrived in Canada, we need to backtrack a bit and pick up the story in Iceland, and then from there work our way westward. Acting on intelligence obtained from the Irish, Norse sailors first sighted Iceland about the year 860, but they did not immediately attempt to colonize it. For the next decade or so, Norse hunters went ashore and reconnoitered the coastal areas, and a few actually set up camp and wintered over. News spread back in Scandinavia that Iceland's many fjords were skirted by rich grasslands suitable for pasturage. Soon, efforts were underway to plant a permanent colony in Iceland. The oldest Icelandic records name the first settler as Ingolf Arnarson, who, in the year 874, with a small group of Norse followers and Irish slaves, built a farm near Reykjavik. Other settlers followed, mostly from that region of Scandinavia of what is today Norway. A stratified society took shape, dominated by the landowning nobles, or jarls, with the lower ranks made up of Norse freemen, also known as carls, and the slaves, or thralls, who were mostly captives taken from Ireland. These captives included a number of Christian Irish women, forced into involuntary concubinage. It's interesting to note that, over time, the offspring of these concubines integrated into Icelandic society so much so that the Irish have significantly contributed to the genetic makeup of the contemporary Icelandic population. The next few hundred years following the Norse settlement of Iceland is known as the Commonwealth period. Since the country had no king, but instead was ruled on the local level by landed chieftains. About a generation after the arrival of the first settlers, in the year 930, the regional chieftains formed an open-air assembly called the Althing. This assembly served as neutral ground where the jarls and the freemen came to settle feuds and adjudicate lawsuits. Since there was no king, the assembly was generally presided over by an elected official called the Law Speaker, who, in addition to serving as moderator, had the job of publicly reciting one-third of the country's law every year during the weeks that the Althing was in session. This egalitarian society lasted until 1262, when for political reasons, the Icelandic jarls voted to accept King Harkon of Norway as their overlord. In any event, during the Commonwealth period, in spite of the moderating effect of the Althing, feuds and homicide remained a common feature of life. Vengeance killings had the potential to get out of hand, so in order to prevent the country from spiraling into full-scale anarchy, the Althing acted as a court and imposed punishment for offenses such as homicide. Since the perpetrators were frequently men of high social rank, it was often impolitic to sentence a killer to death. In many cases, after a guilty verdict had been handed down, the offender would agree to pay a fine to the family of his victims and then go into temporary exile for some determined period of time. Now, at the time of the settlement, the Icelandic Norse were still largely pagans and devotees of the old Norse gods. Christianity was introduced early to Iceland, probably arriving first with the Irish slaves. With the support of the Norwegian king, who had himself accepted Christianity, missionaries from Scandinavia arrived in Iceland about the year 980. Not long afterwards, coinciding events took place which not only set the stage for the Norse discovery of America, but also created the conditions whereby the memory of this discovery would be preserved and handed down to us in written form. The first momentous event took place in the year 1000, when the Icelandic Althing voted to adopt Christianity as Iceland's official religion. We'll talk more about this in a little bit, but before we do, we need to turn our attention to that second coincidental factor that shapes our story, namely the exploits of a violent, volatile man named Erik Thorvaldsson, a man who is better known to us as Erik the Red. Erik Thorvaldsen was born around the year 950 in Norway. The record of his early life is vague, but the sources tell us that his family was exiled from Norway as a punishment for homicide, probably committed by Erik's father sometime in the 960s. Interestingly, we see here that exile as a form of punishment was not unique to the Irish, nor the Icelandic Norse, but it was a practice that the Icelanders imported from their Scandinavian homeland. Anyway, while in exile, Erik's family settled in a place called Drangar in the Westfjords region of Iceland. Now, Erik's family were late arrivals during the settlement period, which meant that most of the best land in Iceland had already been claimed. Not far from where Erik's family settled was a town called Ísafjörður, and in this town lived the sons of one of Iceland's first settlers, a man named Gunnbjörn Ulfsson. In a world where storytelling is considered an art form, there's little doubt that young Erik heard the story of how Gunnbjörn Ulfsson became disoriented at sea during a merchant expedition and drifted westward. Erik probably listened with piqued interest as the storyteller recounted how, when the fog lifted, Gunnbjörn spotted a shoal of rocky islands, or skerries as they are called, somewhere to the west of Iceland. Over the years, Erik must have pondered the implications of this discovery, knowing that the presence of these skerries indicated a more substantial island located nearby. Erik grew to become an influential adult and gathered something of a following. However, Erik had a reputation for being quarrelsome, and as was often the case among the Norse, quarrels led to violence. The sources aren't clear about what exactly happened, but they do tell us that Erik was exiled from Iceland for 3 years in 982 because of some killings. Erik's exile might have been imposed by the national Althing, or perhaps by some smaller local council. Whatever the case, to prevent further violence, Erik was ordered to leave Iceland. Unrepentant and intent on making the most of his time away, Erik gathered 35 of his loyal followers, and boarding a canoe, they went off in search of Gunnbjörn's skerries and whatever land might lie beyond. Sure enough, after sailing westward for an unspecified period of time, Erik and his company came upon an inhospitable, mountainous land whose coast was treacherous and barren. Undaunted, Erik sailed southward and eventually rounded a cape where the rocky coast bent westward before falling off in a chain of fjords and rocky islands that ran to the northwest. It was along these fjords where Erik found grassy pasture land, similar to what he had left behind in Iceland. Intent on spending the winter there, Erik and his band landed and made camp in the vicinity of what would come to be known as the East Settlement, the main hub of Norse Greenland. That following spring, Erik and his men explored the surrounding area. During their forays up north, up that body of water that would later come to be known as the Davis Strait, Erik found evidence that other human beings had recently visited the area. By all indications, Erik's party had stumbled upon an abandoned Inuit hunting camp. Now, the Norse and the Inuit would eventually make contact in Greenland, but that meeting was still in the future. After 3 years in exile, Erik and his party returned home to Iceland. It seems as though the time away had done little to quell Erik's truculent nature. Rivalries flared up again, and this time Erik decided to leave Iceland for good. He publicized his discovery of the new land to the west, naming the place Greenland in an effort to make it sound more attractive and induce settlers to follow him. In about the year 985, Erik sailed for Greenland with between 400 and 500 people, crammed into 14 canoes, along with horses and cattle, sheep and goats, chickens, dogs and cats, and a cargo of household implements and building materials. Eventually, the Greenland Norse would be spread out between two colonies, the so-called East and West Settlements. If you look at a map, and you can find one on my webpage at georgemonahan.com, the West Settlement is really situated more northerly up the Davis Strait than the main East Settlement, which lies further to the south. But no matter, the names East and West stuck. A modest town called Brattahlid grew up in the East Settlement, and this was to serve as the capital of Norse Greenland for the next 500 years. And it was from this base in the East Settlement that the children of Erik the Red set out in their attempt to colonize America. The written records that come down to us about the Norse discovery and attempted colonization of maritime Canada are contained in two sagas. One is called Erik the Red's Saga, and the other is titled The Saga of the Greenlanders. Collectively, they are known as the Vineland Sagas. Taken together, these sagas tell how Erik the Red discovered and settled Greenland, and then how his children explored and attempted to colonize a land that had been discovered to the south and west called Vineland. Okay, so all this talk of sagas. What exactly is a saga? Well, the word saga comes down from the Old Norse language, and it means saying, as in saying a story. Now, this indicates that at first, these stories were not written down, but were rather recited, usually at social gatherings by a skilled storyteller. Most sagas tell of real-world events involving actual people, and in this way they are unlike the medieval stories that come from continental Europe, which often dwell on fantasy themes such as knights fighting dragons or other mythological perils. But the Norse sagas, for the most part, dwell on plausible, real-world events, like feuds and vengeance killings. In other words, the sagas were stories which might have been embellished or contain fictional elements, but the stories seem plausible within the context of Norse culture. The Norse brought their pre-Christian sagas with them from Scandinavia to Iceland, where they continued to enjoy great popularity. But there were also sagas composed in Iceland during the Christian era, too. There are literally hundreds of sagas that have survived in written form, but it's important to remember that the sagas were oral in nature and only committed to writing centuries after their original composition. By and large, most sagas, whether Scandinavian or Icelandic in origin, began to take written form in Iceland in the 12th century. It's also important to keep in mind that the saga writers were mostly educated churchmen and thus possessed a broader knowledge of European and classical literature beyond the Scandinavian tradition. Some modern scholars claim that because of this, the written sagas were tainted with many foreign literary motifs and therefore cloud our understanding of genuine Old Norse culture. Now, I'm not a literary scholar, but I think this argument is overblown. The sagas are a uniquely Nordic form of literature, and to a significant degree, they serve as a window into the mindset of the culture which produced them. Anyone who has spent time reading masterpieces of Old Norse literature, such as Egil's Saga and Niall's Saga, can attest to this. These are world-class epics that simply demand preservation in written form. But what about the more obscure stories? The ones that circulated on a local level and recounted the exploits associated with some lesser-known Icelandic family or personality. There are probably many tales like this from the Old Norse oral tradition that never were written down. Now, this raises an important point. Why would an Icelandic scribe commit one saga to writing and not another? Why does one story of one man's deeds survive, while those of another are completely forgotten? Perhaps the reason has to do with patronage. It's important to keep in mind that the Icelandic scribe who committed the saga to writing often did so because they wanted to commemorate real people and actual events. Remember, the saga writers were for the most part churchmen who might seek to advance their careers by currying favor with powerful people. One way of doing this was to memorialize some great man's ancestor in a well-written saga. And this is exactly why Erik the Red's Saga and the Saga of the Greenlanders have come down to us in written form. As we'll see in a little bit, descendants of the protagonists in these stories served as bishops in the Icelandic church around the time the Vineland sagas were written down. The authors of the Vineland sagas, whoever they were, in addition to preserving good stories for their own sake, probably hoped to ingratiate themselves with the boss by celebrating his ancestors' notable deeds. The events recounted in Erik the Red's Saga and the Saga of the Greenlanders overlap somewhat, and they're even contradictory in some of the details. But since there's agreement in the main narrative, it's possible to synthesize the two texts into a single story. The story begins with the misadventures of an Icelandic sailor and merchant named Bjarni Herjolfsson. Now, Bjarni was a grandson of one of the original settlers of Iceland. While Bjarni was away on business in Norway, Herdolf, his father, went with Eric the Red to settle in Greenland. When Bjarni returned to Iceland, he learned to his disappointment of his father's absence. Determined to spend the winter with his parents, Bjarni decided not to unload his cargo in Iceland, but with his crew, sail on to Greenland and locate the Norse colony there. There was only one problem with this plan. Neither Bjarni nor anyone in his crew had been to Greenland before, and therefore they lacked the first-hand experience with sailing that far to the west. No matter. Bjarni was an accomplished mariner and was able to obtain detailed sailing directions to Greenland during his sojourn in Iceland. Bjarni and his crew confidently set sail westward, and after 3 days they were beyond the sight of land. But then, as often happened, the wind direction changed, and visibility deteriorated to the point where Bjarni and his crew became completely disoriented, in that state of Hafvila we mentioned earlier. Well, Bjarni and his crew continued in Hafvila for many days before the sun reappeared and they got their bearings. After another day of sailing, they sighted land. Since none of them had been to Greenland before, Bjarni and his crew argued amongst themselves as to what land this might be. "Something didn't seem right," Bjarni said. The description he'd obtained about Greenland spoke of mountains and glaciers, but there were none of these here. Instead, Bjarni and his crew gazed upon low hills that were thickly wooded. Clearly, this wasn't Greenland, and the absence of glaciers meant that they had drifted too far south. Bjarni opted not to make landfall, but rather to set a northerly course and press on. After 2 days of sailing, they spotted land again. Again, they found a woodland with no glaciers. Bjarni's men wanted to go ashore on the pretext of replenishing their fresh water supply, but Bjarni flatly refused. Onward they went, and after another 3 days at sea, they spotted a land with mountains and glaciers, but with no observable grassland around the coastal fjords. Declaring the land good for nothing, Bjarni dismissed the idea that this could be Greenland. After 4 more days of sailing, they spotted a land that fit the description of Greenland, and drawing near a headland, they came upon the Norse colony. The saga says that after Bjarni was reunited with his father, he gave up the merchant's seafaring life and in time inherited his father's estate. There was a lot of talk in Greenland about the new land Bjarni had found, as well as a measure of criticism for Bjarni's unwillingness to go ashore and explore a little. There was going to be a follow-up mission to see what was out there, but this time the expedition would be led by a son of Eric the Red, a man known as Leif Erikson. Unlike his father Eric, who clung to his paganism, Leif was a convert to Christianity. During this time, Christians and pagans managed to coexist in both Iceland and Greenland, and although there might have been some family strife over Leif's abandonment of the old gods, it didn't seem to get in the way of Leif inviting his father to come along as the expedition's nominal commander. Eric the Red opted out, though, and decided to remain in Greenland and recuperate from injuries he'd sustained, having recently fallen from his horse. After obtaining sailing directions, Leif purchased Bjarni's ship and gathered a crew of 34 men to accompany him on this mission of exploration. It was about the year 1000 when Leif and his company departed Greenland. Leif followed Bjarni's course in reverse order, so that the first place Leif landed was the last place Bjarni had sighted before he reached Greenland. As commander, Leif had the privilege of assigning names to the newly discovered places, and in a very practical manner, he chose names that described the most prominent or important feature of the new land. At his first landing place, Leif observed large, slab-like stones near the water's edge, so he named the place Helluland, meaning flat stone land in the Old Norse language. This was probably Baffin Island, in the Arctic region of northern Canada. From there, the expedition sailed on to the second place Bjarni had sighted. Leif went ashore and named the low-lying place Markland, meaning woodland. This was in all probability the Canadian province of Labrador. Afterwards, Leif and his company sailed on. Just exactly where Leif Erikson went next is controversial, and scholars still disagree about this. There are some who adamantly believe that Leif Erikson's next stop was the Canadian province of Newfoundland. Others, for very good reasons, believe that Leif landed further south, somewhere in the Canadian Maritimes. In any event, the text says that Leif and his crew sailed on for 2 days after leaving Markland before sighting land again. After sailing around a cape, they maneuvered the canoe up a river and into a lake, and went ashore to build houses, since they planned to spend the winter there. When all was in order, Leif and his men began to explore the surrounding countryside. Where in the world were they? Well, it's a safe bet that the Norse had arrived somewhere along the east coast of North America. But North America is a big place, and scholars have been trying for a long time to locate the exact location of Leif's encampment. The saga writers provide some general information that helps us narrow things down a bit. According to the text, Leif's party observed that both the lake and the river were loaded with large salmon. Also, the land was reportedly so good that no fodder was needed for livestock that winter, and since it never dropped below freezing, the grass withered only slightly. Leif and his crew observed that the days and the nights in this place were of more equal length than they were in Greenland or Iceland, and that in midwinter the sun rose by mid-morning and was still visible by mid-afternoon. This was in contrast to Greenland and Iceland, where the days were much, much shorter in the depth of winter. But it was during one of the excursions from base camp that the most significant discovery was made. Fearing that his men might get lost, Leif gave orders that only half the crew could go exploring at any one time, and that the exploration party should never venture more than a day's journey from camp. No one was to go off on his own. Yet, in spite of these orders, one member of the company got separated from his comrades and was feared lost. What made this especially troublesome was that the missing man was none other than Leif's childhood guardian and foster father, a man named Tyrkir. Now, it's very interesting to note that Tyrkir was not from Scandinavia, but rather was a German from the region near the Rhine. Tyrkir had been missing for many hours, but to Leif's great delight, he made it back to camp with some startling news. Tyrkir was so excited by what he had found that he kept yammering on in German before regaining his composure and switched back to speaking Norse. Tyrkir took a big breath, cleared his parched throat, and announced that he had found grapes. This news seemed too good to be true. "Are you sure?" Leif asked. "How can you be certain you found grapes?" Tyrkir replied, saying that he was certain that they were grapes, and that he knew all about grapes since they grew in abundance in his German homeland. And it's because of this discovery that Leif named the country Vineland. After some time exploring Vineland, Leif ordered his crew to load the canoe with a cargo of grapes and cut timber and prepare for their journey back to Greenland. During the return voyage, not far from the coast of Greenland, Leif spotted another canoe foundering on a shoal. Determining that the lives of the crew were in peril, Leif managed to rescue the 15 men and at least one woman aboard, and also recover a substantial amount of the damaged ship's cargo. This earned Leif the nickname Leif the Lucky. Leif's rescue of the imperiled mariners was to have far-reaching implications. For practical reasons, it was common in Norse culture for more than one family to share a longhouse, and the extension of hospitality, especially toward the victims of a shipwreck, was considered virtuous. With winter setting in, Leif found shelter for the new arrivals in various longhouses, but he invited the shipwreck captain, a Norwegian named Thorir, and his Icelandic wife Gudrid to spend the winter in his longhouse at Brattahlid. Eric the Red died that winter, and illness took many others. Among the dead was Thorir, the shipwrecked captain Leif had rescued. Gudrid, his wife, was left a widow. Now Gudrid is going to play an important role in a later attempt to colonize Vineland, so we'll have more to say about her in a little bit. But before we do, we need to address what has proven to be a persistent and contentious question. Where exactly is this place called Vineland? Speculation runs high, and scholars have suggested places along the Atlantic coast ranging from Newfoundland to New Brunswick, Nova Scotia to Cape Cod, maybe Long Island, maybe even the Chesapeake. Even Florida has been suggested. Clearly, some of the claims are far-fetched. But is it possible from evidence within the sagas to rule out any of these places? One way to narrow things down is to consider the growing range of wild grapes. Even given the fact that global temperatures were a little bit warmer 1,000 years ago, grapes generally did not grow above the 45th parallel. This line of latitude cuts through New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. This leads us to rule out Newfoundland as the location of Vineland. The mention in the sagas of rivers full of salmon and the discovery of wild grain near Leif Settlement conservatively points to an area in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, near Prince Edward Island, as the location of Vineland. Some have narrowed the area down to the vicinity of Miramichi Bay. Having considered a number of arguments, in my opinion, this seems to make the most sense. I'll offer additional evidence for this as the probable location of Vineland once we get a little bit deeper into the story. But right now, we need to examine the next chapter in the Norse attempt to colonize North America. Perhaps Leif made additional trips to Vineland after that first year of exploration, but we can't be certain of it since the texts are mute on this point. Was it his intention to eventually settle in Vineland and enjoy his leadership status, just as his father had done after founding the Greenland colony? That would seem logical, since the texts make very clear that he refused to cede ownership of the house he had built in Vineland. Whatever his intentions, Leif did at least offer to lend this house to the next party that set out from Greenland. The next expedition was led by Leif's brother Thorvald, also a son of Eric the Red. Since Leif's return the year before, everyone in Greenland had been talking about Vineland, and Thorvald was intent on making an expedition there himself. Borrowing Leif's canoe, Thorvald gathered a crew of 30 men and set off in search of Vineland that following spring. The texts tell us that Thorvald found Leif's camp and settled in for the winter. That spring, Thorvald and his men explored the land to the west, finding many forested islands with white sandy beaches. It was during one of these forays that Thorvald's party first found evidence that the area might be inhabited, having come across something vaguely described as a wooden grain cover. No other artifacts are mentioned, nor does the text provide any more precise details on the object the party had found. An additional bit of evidence is mentioned in the sagas that might help us narrow down the location of Vineland, and it's mentioned in relation to a mishap that occurred during Thorvald's second summer of exploring. That summer, the saga tells us that Thorvald sailed north around a headland where his party was driven ashore, smashing the keel of their ship. After making repairs, Thorvald had the broken keel raised up on its end, probably to serve as some kind of aid to navigation and as a warning to other mariners of a dangerous shoal nearby. He named the place Keel Point, and from a description of the geography and by retracing his sailing directions, it seems probable that this spot was somewhere along the northern part of Cape Breton Island. From the lay of things, this place is Vineland in the vicinity of Miramichi Bay. I've put up a map of the area on my webpage if you'd like to take a look. Anyway, it wasn't long after the mishap at Keel Point that things took a tragically violent turn. According to the text, Thorvald and his party continued exploring to the east and at some point went ashore on a forested cape. The area seemed so agreeable that Thorvald declared his desire to build a farm there and make the place his home. Almost immediately afterward, Thorvald and his men came upon 9 men, hiding along the beach under animal skin boats. In all likelihood, this was a native hunting party, probably laying in wait for waterfowl. Similar methods are still used in the woodlands of North America, where hunters wait for their quarry in camouflage duck blinds. Seemingly without provocation, Thorvald's party fell upon the natives and killed all but one of them, who ran off. Soon, a large group of natives in hide boats were racing down the coast and attacked Thorvald's company as they sought to escape in their canoe. The Norse escaped without injury, all except for Thorvald, who was struck in his armpit by an arrow and died shortly afterwards. With few other options, Thorvald's men buried their leader on shore, attended by Christian rituals. Because of the cross Thorvald's men erected over his grave, they named the spot Cross Point. Deprived of their leader, The expedition returned to Greenland that following spring, bringing with them a cargo of grapes and grapevines and the sad news of Thorvald's death. Thus closes the report of the second Norse expedition to Vineland and the first recorded contact between Europeans and Native Americans in the New World. But who were these native people? The saga and the later Norse texts simply refer to the American natives as Skraelings, a word variously translated as the Screechers or the Uglies. Since the Norse used the term when referring to the Inuit in Greenland and in Arctic Canada, and the various Indian people they encountered further south, we can't be sure who these people were that Thorvald and his company encountered. They were almost certainly not Inuit, since all indications are that Vineland lay far to the south of the Inuit's southernmost migration limit. Most likely the people Thorvald encountered were the ancestors of the Mi'kmaqs of New Brunswick, but it's also possible that this first recorded contact took place between the Norse and the Beothuk of Newfoundland, or possibly even the Montagnais of southern Labrador. In my opinion, Thorvald and his company probably crossed paths with Mi'kmaqs, since I think Vineland was located in New Brunswick, near Miramichi Bay. By the way, this is just an educated guess after I've weighed the evidence. Placing Vineland in New Brunswick just seems to make the most sense to me. But no matter. What we know for certain is that the first encounter between the Norse and the Indians turned violent. All we have is the Norse version of this encounter, and it's curious that the text offers no justifiable reason why Thorvald and his men launched an unprovoked attack. Sadly, this would not be the last time a potentially friendly encounter between the Norse and the natives deteriorated into senseless violence. Meanwhile, back in Greenland, events were unfolding which would set the stage for the next attempted colonization of North America. Early in the story, you may recall we mentioned how Gudrid was left widowed when her husband fell ill and died. Gudrid was said to be very beautiful, and soon she remarried, this time to Thorstein, son of Eric the Red, and therefore brother of Leif Erikson and the recently deceased Thorvald. Now, like his brothers, Thorstein Erikson was a Christian, as was Gudrid. As an act of filial piety, Thorstein and Gudrid determined to travel to Vineland and recover Thorvald's body so that it could be given a proper Christian burial in Greenland. The saga says that Thorstein and Gudrid set out with a crew of 25 men, but soon they became disoriented in poor visibility and wandered about in that state of Hafvilla we mentioned earlier. The conditions were such that they drifted far up the Davis Strait, and when the weather lifted, they made for the more northerly Norse settlement in Greenland, the so-called West Settlement. Here, misfortune befell poor Gudrid again after sickness carried off Thorstein, leaving her widowed a second time. With few other options, she returned to Brattahlid in the East Settlement and lived under the guardianship of her brother-in-law, Leif Erikson. But it wasn't long before suitors arrived, and once again Gudrid found herself a bride, this time marrying a respectable Icelandic merchant named Thorfinn Karlsefni, who had only recently arrived from a trading expedition in Norway. Leif Erikson and Karlsefni seemed to have gotten along pretty well, and soon there was talk of sending another expedition to Vineland under Karlsefni's command. Karlsefni and Gudrid, along with a crew of 60 men and 5 women, formed something of a joint partnership, agreeing to divvy up equal shares of whatever profits might come from this venture. As before, Leif only agreed to lend Karlsefni his house in Vineland, all the while retaining full ownership, perhaps because he himself planned to settle there in the future, but we can't be certain of this. In any event, Karlsefni and Gudrid arrived in Vineland without mishap, and the crew set about unloading their supplies, including livestock that they had brought with them from Greenland. In addition to building more houses, they cut down trees and gathered stores of the local produce for eventual shipment back to Greenland. Now, our two sources for this expedition, respectively titled The Saga of the Greenlanders and Eric the Red's Saga, agree in the essentials, but the story is embellished with greater details in Eric the Red's Saga. This version of the story tells of a longer outward-bound voyage and identifies by name some of the more prominent expedition members. Eric the Red saga also mentions that two Irish slaves accompanied Karlsefni and Gudrid on this expedition. At one point, these unnamed Irishmen were put ashore with an assignment to reconnoiter the interior, and after 3 days, they returned carrying not only grapes, but also self-sown wheat. Whatever this indigenous grain was, its existence indicated that the land was productive and that farming in the region would be fairly easy. Yet, in spite of these promising discoveries, the first year proved difficult and famine set in. Things, it seemed, were so bad that the author of Eric the Red's saga includes a vignette about one expeditionary's bout with depression. Things seemed so bleak that the unfortunate man was driven to the brink of suicide. In this instance, he was rescued by the intervention of his friends. Thankfully, the expedition survived the winter, and during the summer of the following year, the saga says the expeditionaries became aware of the natives. And so it happened that the Norse and the Indians were about to make their second recorded contact. According to the sagas, sometimes afterward, an unspecified number of Indians approached the Norse by boat, waving wooden poles that the Norse said made a swishing sound. Completely unfamiliar with the Indian customs, the Norse could not discern if this was a sign of friendship or hostility. With the hope of signaling a peaceful stance, the Norse displayed a white shield to the approaching Indians. Apparently, the Indians found this weird gesture confusing. They marveled, the saga says, and then they went away. The Norse expeditionaries spent the winter in Vineland without incident. So far, so good. In the spring, the Indians returned, this time carrying bundles of furs, seemingly intent on trading with the Norse. In a comical scene, as the Indians approached the Norse camp, a bull that the Norse had brought over from Greenland came out into the clearing. Since the Indians had never seen the likes of a bull before, the snorting animal scared them off. But the Indians overcame their trepidation and returned. Sadly, neither group understood the other's language. Neither did they understand the boundaries of what the other group considered culturally acceptable. This misunderstanding bred suspicion, which in turn had the potential to result in violence. Overcoming their fears of the bull, the Indians approached Karlsefni's farm and tried to enter the longhouse, but they found the door barred and the Norse in a defensive posture. Undeterred, the Indians sat down in the farmyard, opened their bundles, and displayed their pelts to the paranoid Norse, who were looking on with concern. Through signs and gestures, Karlsefni and the Indians began to negotiate, and the Norse understood that the Indians were offering to trade their pelts for iron weapons. Karlsefni would have none of that, but offered the Indians milk instead. Rather than scoffing at this seemingly unequal trade, the Indians gladly accepted the offer. Soon, the Indians were exchanging their pelts for pieces of red cloth, which they seemed to regard as highly valuable. In spite of this peaceful encounter, Karlsefni knew that his people were greatly outnumbered by the Indians in Vineland. Hedging against the possibility that things might turn violent between the two groups, Karlsefni ordered his people to construct a palisade around their settlement. Shortly after this, the texts record another monumental event in the history of European exploration. That autumn, in Vineland, Gudrid gave birth to a son, the first documented European child born in the New World. His parents named the child Snorri Karlsefnisson. Interestingly, Snorri's descendants were to become bishops in Iceland in the 12th and 13th centuries, and as I mentioned earlier, the Vineland sagas were probably written down specifically in an effort to flatter these powerful men. In any event, just as Karlsefni feared, amicable relations with the natives were not to last. At the beginning of the second winter, a much larger group of Indians returned, offering the same trade goods as before. The Indians now showed an even greater interest in trading for iron weapons, but Karlsefni refused any commerce of this sort, and ordered his people only to offer foodstuffs in exchange for the Indians' animal skins. Nevertheless, the Indians were persistent, and matters soon got out of hand. Violence erupted when an Indian tried to lay hold of a Norse weapon, and in the scuffle, an Indian was killed. The rest of the Indians ran off, leaving their goods scattered about, while Karlsefni and his men prepared for imminent battle. Realizing they were outnumbered, Karlsefni hoped to even the odds by drawing the Indians into the open on the beach. There, the Norse cut loose their bull, knowing that it would demoralize the Indians, since they found the beast so frightening. In the ensuing melee, many Indians were killed. Now, our two sources for this encounter offer slightly different but equally strange versions of what happened during this skirmish. According to the Saga of the Greenlanders, in the middle of the fight, the Indian chief discovered a Norse axe lying on the ground. Hefting the axe, he threw it at a fellow Indian and killed him on the spot. The chief recovered the weapon, examined it again, then threw it into the sea. With that, the Indians ran off without further incident. Strangely, no explanation is offered as to why an Indian would kill one of his own men. If that wasn't strange enough, Eric the Red's saga says that during the confrontation, the Norse retreated to a defendable position, whereupon Eric the Red's illegitimate daughter, Freydis, took up the sword of a fallen Norse and, baring her breast, smacked it with the sword. This so disturbed the Indians that they ran off. This version of the story also mentions the incident with the axe, but in Eric the Red's saga, the Indians test it on a tree, then on a stone before tossing it away. This seems more plausible than testing it on a fellow Indian. In the end, only two Norse were killed, while many more Indians lay dead on the battlefield. Other inconsistencies in the texts suggest that the version of the story told in Eric the Red's saga conflates the Thorvald expedition with the Karlsefni expedition, because it places Thorvald's death by arrow shortly after this skirmish with the Indians. You can make of these inconsistencies what you will. I, for one, take them with a grain of salt, and I don't believe they invalidate the bigger picture. After the fight with the Indians, Karlsefni said he no longer wanted to remain in Vineland and decided that the company should return to Greenland the following spring. That winter, they gathered a cargo and prepared for the journey home. Tensions among the Norse were running so high that quarrels broke out that winter, mostly over the women. That spring, the expedition split into different parties, each of which returned to Greenland separately. On the return journey, Karlsefni's group put ashore at some point and encountered a small group of natives. The adults escaped, but two boys were taken captive and brought back to Greenland, where they were baptized and taught the Norse language. Now, the texts tell us that when these boys became conversant in Norse, they explained all sorts of things to their captors about the Indians and about the country surrounding Vineland. They named certain Indian kings, but these names bear no linguistic connection to any known Indian language. The author of the sagas probably just included whatever exotic-sounding nonsense he could come up with just to embellish the story. The boys also mentioned a land across from theirs where the people wore white garments and waved white flags and banners. This, they said, was reputed to be the land of the white men. This sounds like more embellishment on the part of the saga writer, but its inclusion in the story has fueled modern speculation about a possible pre-Norse Celtic colony in America. Remember the Irish folktale about St. Brendan's Isle? Well, here it seems is independent corroboration of a white European settlement in the New World that predates the Norse. Well, what do you think of that? Well, I, for one, think it's nonsense. The saga is vague regarding the location of this supposed land of white men, and since the author was shamelessly willing to include exotic-sounding gibberish just to spice up the passage a little, I can't help but take the whole vignette with a heavy dose of salt. Perhaps the boys were talking about the Indians' growing awareness of the Norse colony in Greenland. Whatever the boys meant, there is no archaeological evidence that the Irish colonized America before the Norse. But if the story of the captive Indian boys proves anything, it proves that the Norse thought nothing of capturing Indians as slaves. Now, we have no record of the Norse engaging in an ongoing Indian slave trade, but there is the real possibility that during additional unrecorded expeditions to North America, the Norse brought back Indian captives to Greenland, possibly for sale as slaves in Iceland. Knowing what we know about how the Norse treated the Irish, this certainly seems plausible. In fact, recent studies have found that certain segments of the modern Icelandic population carry American Indian DNA. And from the predictable way these genetic markers mutate over time, its introduction into the Icelandic gene pool must have taken place around the time of the Vineland expeditions. The Norse had Irish concubines. It now seems likely that a few Indians were also forced into similar circumstances. The sagas tell of a fourth and final voyage to Vineland, and during this expedition, everything seemed to go wrong almost from the start. The problem had nothing to do with famine or conflict with the natives. Instead, this mission failed because of infighting and treachery among the Norse themselves. We have already mentioned Freydis, the illegitimate daughter of Eric the Red. According to the text, Freydis obtained Leif Erikson's house in Vineland on loan, and then contracted a partnership with two Icelandic merchants, brothers actually, according to the text, to go out to Vineland and make a fourth attempt to establish a settlement. But right from the start, quarrels broke out because of Freydis's dishonesty. Freydis and the two brothers each had their own ship, and agreed to limit their respective complements to not more than 30 men and women. But Freydis broke faith and brought an extra 5 men with her, having hidden them aboard her ship. When the two ships landed in Vineland, Freydis also denied the use of Leif's house to the people from the other company. As a result, the two parties split up, and the brothers were forced to build a separate longhouse to accommodate their men. In spite of some friendly interaction between the two settlement parties, the situation deteriorated as winter set in. Things came to a head when Freydis goaded her husband into killing all the men of the other party as vengeance against her false claim that one of the brothers physically abused her. Before the mayhem subsided, Freydis herself killed 5 women with an axe and then threatened to kill anyone who spoke of her treachery back in Greenland. With the stolen ship and cargoed of the murdered Norse, Freydis and her terrorized company returned to Greenland. But in time, in spite of her threats and bribes, word of Freydis's misdeeds leaked. Disgraced and more or less confined to her farm, the worst punishment that seems to have befallen Freydis was social ostracism. So ends the last chapter in the Vineland sagas. There's no further mention in the Norse sources of any attempt to settle Vineland after this. But what about Karlsefni and Gudrid? And whatever happened to their child Snorri, the first European born in the New World? After returning to Greenland, the sagas tell us that Karlsefni and his family sailed to Norway, where they sold their goods and became very wealthy. Interestingly, the saga mentions that while he was in Norway, Karlsefni was approached by a German traveler from Bremen in Saxony who desired to purchase the decorative prow of his ship. Now, the saga says that this figurehead had been carved from burl wood, which Karlsefni had obtained in Vineland. Although Karlsefni was reluctant to part with this memento of his adventures, the German offered quite a bit of money for the ornament. Karlsefni relented and sold the figurehead, and soon afterward he and Gudrid returned to Iceland and purchased an estate there. After Karlsefni's death, Gudrid made a pilgrimage, possibly to Jerusalem and Rome. After her return to Iceland, Gudrid became something of a religious recluse. Her son Snorri took over the estate, and his descendants, as we said, rose to prominence in Iceland in the following centuries. So much for the descendants of Eric the Red. But is this really the end of the story? Isn't there anything more to be said about Vineland? And whatever happened to the Norse colony in Greenland? Remarkably, the Vineland sagas are actually not the first textual source referencing the Norse discovery of North America. A few centuries before the Vineland sagas took written form, Vineland was mentioned in a book written by a churchman named Adam of Bremen in about the year 1073. This book, titled the Gesta Hammabergensis, is an important source for the history of Northern Europe during the Viking Age. But since this book was largely forgotten until its rediscovery in the 16th century, it's questionable how much influence this book had, and therefore how much was actually known about Vineland outside a tight circle of Norse merchants and aristocrats before the 16th century. In any event, in the text, Adam claims to have learned of islands in the North Atlantic, such as Greenland and Vineland, from King Sven of Denmark. Adam affirms that Vineland was so named because of the good grapes found there, and he mentions also that the land abounded with self-sown grain. Now, although Adam of Bremen's work was not really influential until its rediscovery in the 16th century, two points emerge. The first is that Greenland and Iceland were both very much a part of a flourishing trade network that connected them with Norway as well as with other European seaports during the Middle Ages. This interconnectedness is corroborated by the fact that Gudrid and other prominent Icelanders frequently made pilgrimages to Christian shrines throughout the Old World. What are we to make of this? Well, the evidence shows that people who had been to Vineland, or knew people that had been there, traveled widely during the 11th century, and that knowledge of its existence circulated among merchants, nobles, and scholars in Northern Europe. At some point in the ensuing centuries, though, awareness of Vineland fades from the European consciousness. However, Greenland did not fade from view, and existence of the Norse settlement there was acknowledged by Europeans right up until that community's collapse in the early 16th century. The second point is really a question. Given all that Adam of Bremen learned about Vineland from the King of Denmark, can it be possible that the Greenland Norse really only made four attempts to plant a settlement in North America? Is it true that all efforts ceased after the catastrophic debacle led by Freydis Eriksdotter, or were there subsequent undocumented missions? What about contact with the more northerly provinces of Canada, like Newfoundland and Labrador, and the Arctic region on the western side of the Davis Strait? Did contact with these places suddenly end? Clearly, when it came to Vineland, one of the biggest obstacles the Norse faced was that there was never an adequate base population in Greenland to support a settlement in North America. There is, however, sufficient textual and archaeological evidence to suggest that Norse contact with Vineland and other parts of Canada went on for much longer than is mentioned in the sagas. In one instance, the Icelandic Annals mentions that a bishop by the name of Eric departed his see in Greenland in 1121 in search of Vineland. There's no mention of Bishop Eric after this. Perhaps he made it to Vineland. If so, were there any Norse there to receive him? This we cannot say. Neither can we find any record of his return. We do know that 3 years after Eric's departure, another bishop of Greenland was appointed in his stead. One of the most precious commodities in Norse Greenland was timber for construction. We know that the Greenland Norse used wood to build their houses and also to fashion objects for personal use, such as furniture and tools. We also know from archaeological and textual evidence that the Greenland Norse had access to wood for shipbuilding and repair. But we must ask, where were they getting this wood from, since Greenland was devoid of trees? One way the Greenlanders obtained wood was to scavenge the coastline along the Davis Strait and collect driftwood that had been carried from Siberia on the drifting Arctic ice sheets. Now, driftwood was useful for some purposes, but generally speaking, it's not good construction material, since immersion in salt water causes it to lose its elasticity and become hard. Driftwood is almost impossible to use as a material for shipbuilding, but cured timber is preferred for its flexibility and buoyancy. Now, since we know the Greenland Norse not only repaired, but also built ships, they had to have access to cut timber. It's possible that cargoes of timber were carried to Greenland all the way from Norway, but the cost of this would have been prohibitive. Reason dictates that the Greenland Norse obtained timber just a short sailing distance to the southwest in Markland, what is today the Canadian province of Labrador. Remarkably, Norse documents from 1347 state that Norse Greenlanders actually constructed a canoe in Markland. Additional evidence of ongoing contact between Greenland and Canada is mentioned in 1360, when an unnamed English Franciscan made a visit to Greenland and accompanied a party of Norse on an expedition far up the Davis Strait. During this expedition, the English traveler reported spotting a group of 23 Inuit on the shore. Further inland, the Franciscan reported finding a great piece of ship's planking and other baulks which had been used in big ships, besides many trunks of trees which at some earlier date had been hewn down. The English Franciscan also reported that, with certainty, people had lived in the area but were now gone. Now, it's not clear which side of the Davis Strait our English traveler visited, but in all likelihood this abandoned place was in the vicinity of the West Settlement, which we know was shrinking in population around this time. Whatever the case, our traveler provides eyewitness verification that the Greenland Norse at one time operated a shipyard far up the Davis Strait and had accumulated a stockpile of hewn wood there for ship's construction. This was hewn wood, mind you, not driftwood, and the odds are that it came from Canada. Further evidence that the Greenland Norse had ongoing contact with Canada is demonstrated by the discovery of iron blooms on Baffin Island, in an archaeological site associated with the English explorer and mining entrepreneur Martin Frobisher. We'll have more to say about Frobisher in an upcoming episode, but suffice it to say here that during a 1993 study of this site, there is evidence that Frobisher tried to re-smelt pieces of iron he probably found locally. It seems highly unlikely that Frobisher would have carried iron with him all the way from England, only to attempt to smelt it in a place like Baffin Island, which is almost devoid of fuel. It just doesn't make any sense. In all probability, the Englishman found this iron slag, which is really a byproduct of a previous attempt at smelting, lying about in some abandoned encampment on Baffin Island. The problem is, though, neither the Indians nor the Inuit had knowledge of iron smelting. When tested in 1993, metallurgists dated the iron blooms to the period when the Norse community in Greenland was thriving. The best hypothesis so far about how the iron got to Baffin Island was that Norse walrus hunters transported it there. Finding themselves in a pinch, maybe they lost some of their gear. The Norse attempted to smelt their raw iron and fashion replacement hunting implements. Whatever the case, the Baffin Island iron blooms from the 16th century Martin Frobisher site are almost certainly of Norse origin. And if so, they are further evidence of Norse contact with Canada during the Greenland period. But the very best evidence of Norse contact with Atlantic Canada comes from the Lance Ameadows archaeological site in northern Newfoundland. The site was discovered in 1960 by Norwegian explorer Helge Ingstad and his wife, archaeologist Anne Stein Ingstad, while searching for tangible evidence of the Norse Vineland colony. At a spot in northern Newfoundland, long mistaken for an Indian encampment, the Ingstads excavated Viking-era longhouses and outbuildings, such as a carpentry shop, each of typical Norse design. They also excavated an iron smithy, which contained a forge and bits of iron slag. As we've said, neither the Indians nor the Inuit possessed this technology. Nor is there evidence of any Indian occupation at or near this site for the period in question. There were, however, many Viking-era artifacts peculiar to both men and women found at the site, including a bone knitting needle, a spindle for making yarn, and loom weights. In addition to the wood shop and the smithy, the archaeologists found a specialized area for repairing boats that contained worn iron rivets. Judging from the evidence, the Lance Ameadows site could support between 30 and 160 people, and was occupied around the year 1000, which is consistent with the known Norse expeditions mentioned in the Vineland saga. Interestingly, too, the site was not occupied for very long. According to the archaeologists, the Norse stayed there for only a few years before abandoning the site. Now, in spite of Helge Ingstad's enthusiastic and spirited arguments, Lance Ameadows is not Vineland. As I mentioned earlier, neither grapes nor river salmon naturally occur this far north, and these items were said to be in abundance in Vineland. Interestingly, the archaeologists found butternuts among the foodstuffs excavated at Lance Ameadows. These type of nuts do not grow north of New Brunswick, so their occurrence at the Lance Ameadows site means that they had to have been brought there from further south. What does all this mean? If Lance Ameadows is in fact a Norse occupation site, but not Vineland of the sagas, What is it then? The best we can say is that Lance Amedeus served as a stopover point on the way to Vineland from Greenland, but that its existence was never mentioned in the sagas. To date, it is the only undisputed Norse occupation site in North America outside of Greenland. There are other archaeological finds that hint at ongoing Norse contact with North America, but much of this evidence is problematic. One of the better artifacts we have is a small copper coin popularly known as the Main Penny. This coin was found in an Indian trash midden in 1957 near the town of Blue Hill, Maine, and was minted in Norway between 1065 and 1080. Coins like this continued to be widely circulated in the 12th and 13th centuries, and although some think the coin is evidence of the Norse having visited as far south as Maine, others think the coin passed to the Indians from the Norse in Labrador, and then made its way south as it was passed among various Indian groups as some type of prestige item. Some claim the find is an out-and-out hoax, and that this authentic Norse coin was unscrupulously planted at an Indian archaeological site. Whatever the case, there are more questions than answers regarding the Main Penny, and the authenticity of the find is still subject to debate. Finally, there's the discovery of a chert projectile point in the west settlement of Greenland of a style unknown among the Inuit. The point was excavated in the 1930s in a churchyard that was constructed after the period recounted in the Vineland sagas. Although inconclusive, the discovery of a stone projectile point of probable Indian origin indicates that the Norse continued to have contact with North American Indians, at least in a sporadic fashion, after the period mentioned in the Vineland sagas. This seems substantiated by the occurrence of American Indian DNA in the genetic makeup of the contemporary Icelandic population, as we had mentioned earlier. So, in summation, we must conclude that there were many more instances of Norse contact with America than the sagas document. How extensive and ongoing these contacts were is open to speculation, but it did not simply cease after the last of the settlement missions mentioned in the Vineland sagas. If Vineland was forgotten by the outside world, its existence was still acknowledged by the Greenland Norse, who continued to travel to Newfoundland and Labrador to extract bog iron and lumber, and to Baffin Island to hunt and fish. Before we conclude, it might be interesting to examine just a few of the well-known hoaxes and false attributions associated with the Norse in North America. During the 19th and early 20th centuries, Viking fever spread across America, and it became vogue for enthusiasts to try to find evidence that the Norse established a community in the territorial United States long before the Pilgrim Fathers set foot on Plymouth Rock. The problem is that in many cases, the evidence is at best spurious, and at worst, blatantly bogus. For a long time, wishful thinking Viking enthusiasts pointed to the famed Newport Tower in Rhode Island as evidence that the Narragansett Bay area is the true location of Leif Erikson's Vineland. Far from being a Viking era structure, archaeological evidence has proven that the Newport Tower is nothing more than the remnant of a colonial era English windmill. An even more flamboyant attempt to place the Vikings deep within the confines of the territorial United States was the discovery in 1898 of the Kensington Runestone. This monument, purportedly inscribed by Vikings who had penetrated deep into Minnesota, was discovered, so it was claimed, by a Swedish immigrant who was clearing stumps on his land. Upon examination, the stone was found to be inscribed with runes, the ancient Scandinavian writing symbols, and the inscription said it was left as a memorial to 10 Norse expeditionaries who had died while exploring the region around the Great Lakes. At first, the Kensington Runestone generated great excitement, until its text was recognized as a modern Swedish dialect, and the actual inscription was found to have been made with modern masonry tools. The Swedish immigrant who supposedly found the stone never fessed up, but it was later discovered that he had a lifelong fascination with Scandinavian runes and had also once worked as a stonemason. There have been many stories over the years about backyard excavations of Viking-era metal tools. There are also plenty of Viking-era weapons and armor that have surfaced on the American antiquities market under mysterious circumstances. all have proven to be modern knockoffs. Recently, I've even read on Facebook about a supposed Viking-era canoe found in Tennessee, along a tributary of the Mississippi River. This is just more wishful thinking, unsupported by any credible proof. Hoaxes of this sort can be entertaining diversions. I myself have written a comedic novel about what might happen when people get caught up in the hype surrounding the discovery of a controversial archaeological find. Please, by all means, if you want a good laugh about this sort of thing, read my novel, Artifact. But a hoax can become a serious matter when people are willing to pay exorbitant sums of money on fraudulent relics. Such was the case with a transparently bogus find, the so-called Vineland map. This forgery surfaced on the rare book market in 1957 and appeared to be a pre-Columbian map that depicted parts of the New World in great detail. The map was not claimed to be of Norse origin, but it did demonstrate extensive geographical knowledge of Greenland and of a territory labeled Vineland, which looked remarkably like the Labrador and Newfoundland coast. In a goofy fit of enthusiasm, an anonymous Yale alumnus purchased the map for $300,000 and donated it to the university. The problem, though, is that the map is a modern forgery. Now, there are numerous proofs that the Vineland map is a fake, not the least of which is that the ink with which it's drawn has been chemically dated to the 20th century. But as interesting as the controversy surrounding the Vineland map is, it's a bit off the topic of this podcast, so I'm going to leave it at that. So, as we've seen, the Greenland Norse continued to have contact with North America well after the year 1000, which is roughly the date of the Vineland expeditions mentioned in the sagas. But what then ultimately happened to the Norse settlement in Greenland? Although the community survived there for over 500 years, by about the year 1500, the Norse Greenland settlement ceased to exist. What then happened to the Greenland Norse? Where did they go? For a long time, the decline of the Norse population in Greenland was thought to be gradual, and its causes were attributed to a period of global cooling in the Middle Ages known as the Mini Ice Age. This climate phenomenon, it was believed, contributed to the spread of disease in Greenland, and also to the scarcity of food, resulting in widespread malnutrition. As the earth cooled, the boundary of the Arctic ice advanced in a southerly direction, bringing with it sea mammals such as walruses and whales. Not far behind came the Thule Inuit, who hunted these mammals as a food source. It was long thought that the Thule Inuit ravaged the outnumbered Norse population in Greenland, subjecting those not killed during the fighting to enslavement. Those who survived were thought to have forsaken the Christian religion, as they either willingly intermarried with the Inuit or were forced into concubinage. Now, there might very well be some underlying truth to these assumptions, but perhaps the stories of mass starvation, Inuit depredations, and widespread apostasy are exaggerated. Of the two major Norse population centers in Greenland, we know that the West Settlement was the first to collapse, and that happened sometime in the mid to late 14th century. This was followed by the East Settlement, which was abandoned by about the year 1500. Yes, the Norse settlements in Greenland ceased to exist, but is it possible that the evidence of its tragic demise has been misinterpreted? It is certainly true that the global climate began to get colder soon after Eric the Red settled in Greenland in the late 10th century. It's also true that the Inuit followed the ice southward, eventually encroaching on the West Settlement. Undoubtedly, there were hostile encounters between the Norse and the Inuit, yet the archaeological evidence does not reveal the burning, destruction, and mass graves associated with a catastrophic violent encounter. Neither is there evidence for apostasy. In fact, the archaeological evidence from late Norse grave sites in Greenland indicate that Christian burial customs persisted right up until the colony's abandonment. What exactly happened then? It's impossible to say for certain, but an alternative theory has been put forward that much more plausibly fits our evidence. With the advance of the ice and the Inuit, the West Settlement found itself cut off from timber supplies and bog iron from across the Davis Strait. Since the West Settlement could not repair and replace its fleet of cargo ships, It was unable to trade its walrus ivory and sealskins with the East Settlement, which had much closer commercial ties to Europe through Iceland and Norway. As the West Settlement's isolation increased, there is evidence that the community fell victim not to Inuit attacks, but to the incursions of English fishermen who were increasingly plying the waters of the Western Atlantic. Now, English fishermen were known to engage in unscrupulous sidelines, such as piracy and kidnapping, as a way of supplementing their income. If circumstances found an English ship shorthanded, English captains were known to recruit, and in some instances, outright Shanghai people in foreign ports. And there are records of them doing exactly this in Iceland around this time. Is it possible the English resorted to the same strong-arm tactics with the West Settlement Norse in Greenland? It's also possible that many Norse of the West Settlement willingly signed on as crewmen on English ships, lured away by the promise of steady pay and a chance for economic improvement. If the cream of the West Settlement's manhood forsook their homeland in this manner, how long could the community sustain itself? Those who remained might have realized that staying on was a losing proposition. And the evidence suggests that the remnant of the population left the West Settlement in one mass departure. Did they all just decide one day to pull up stakes and move en masse to the more viable East Settlement? This seems most likely. Now, the East Settlement in Greenland lingered on a while longer, but outside pressure began to take its toll. As subjects of Norway, the people of Iceland and the Greenland Norse were required to pay taxes, but the Norwegian king was neglecting his obligation to dispatch merchant ships to his Atlantic dependencies. The people of Iceland and Greenland demanded consumer goods, and since they felt abandoned by the Norwegian monarch, they willingly engaged in contraband trade amongst themselves and also with the English. From the mid-14th century into the 15th century, English merchant shipping, both contraband and legal, took advantage of the declining Norse interest in Iceland and Greenland. One of the most important trade items the English wanted was codfish, which all Europeans were increasingly coming to rely on as a source of protein in their diet. English merchants were trading for Icelandic cod, but soon English fishermen were hauling in their own catch of cod from Icelandic waters. The English, like the Norse before them, were drawn further westward in search of better fishing. As they sailed further westward, they came into contact not only with Greenland, as we've just said, but also with other western lands like Labrador and Newfoundland. I'm going to give you a little teaser for an upcoming episode. I'm not going to go into this right now, but we know from Ferdinand Columbus's biography of his father that as a younger man, Christopher Columbus sailed 100 leagues beyond Iceland aboard an English fishing ship operated out of the English port of Bristol in 1477. Ferdinand Columbus mentions that this expedition was instrumental in shaping his father's knowledge of the Atlantic wind system, and that this knowledge would come in handy during the later voyages of discovery. But that's all I'm going to say about this right now. You'll have to wait for the upcoming episode about Columbus to hear more about this. In any event, English cod fishermen, lured ever westward in search of better fishing grounds, faced something of a dilemma. Cod fishing was such a lucrative business because the fish were fairly easy to preserve before going up for sale in the fish market. You could preserve cod by salting them aboard ship, but this method took a lot of salt, and in the end, this reduced the actual amount of fish you could store in the ship's hold. The best method of preserving cod was to dry it. But this method took time and required that the fish be dried on racks set up on shore. Icelandic fishermen were willing to sell their dried cod to the English, but they surely did not want to give the English the privilege of coming ashore in Iceland to dry their own fish. The English realized that in order to maximize their profits from cod fishing, they needed to cut out the Icelandic middleman and find a place somewhere in the Western Atlantic where they could go ashore and dry their own catch. This is exactly why English merchants from the port of Bristol launched two expeditions in the 1480s to locate the fabled Island of Brazil that was rumored to exist somewhere in the Western Atlantic. If the Bristol merchants were successful in finding a Western Atlantic shore base where they could dry their cod, English fishermen stood to substantially increase their profits. There's no official record of the Bristol explorers ever finding this island of Brazil, but it is very possible that English fishermen stumbled upon Newfoundland and began using it to dry cod before its official discovery a decade later. Remember, the discovery of land in the Western Atlantic was a trade secret that English fishermen would have been very reluctant to publicize. It's interesting to note that the explorer John Cabot, who officially discovered Newfoundland in 1497, sailed aboard a Bristol ship with a crew of Bristol mariners who probably knew exactly where to lead the eager explorer because they had been there before. We're going to revisit this topic in a later episode in this series. But to come back to the final question, what then finally happened to the East settlement of Greenland? Like the West settlement, it seems to have been abandoned all at once, right around the year 1500. This was shortly after the official discovery of Newfoundland by John Cabot. To the chagrin of his Bristol benefactors, Cabot's discovery was widely publicized across Western Europe, and soon the English fishermen found themselves competing with the Portuguese and the Basques for dominance in the codfish trade. We know that Portuguese explorers and entrepreneurs piggybacked on the success of Cabot's recent discovery and were themselves active in Greenland and Labrador between 1501 and 1502. One theory about the fate of the Greenland Norse has them sailing away with the Portuguese, perhaps to found a cod fishing base on the Labrador coast. Maybe it was an English fishing fleet that carried off the few remaining Norse from the East settlement. We don't know for sure what exactly happened, but we do know that there's no evidence that the Norse were massacred. They simply seem to have left. And with that, I think it's time to bring this episode to a close. In our next episode of the Age of Discovery and Conquest podcast, we're going to talk about the Portuguese and how, in their quest for gold and spices, they rounded the Cape of Good Hope and laid the route bare to the spice emporiums of India. More information about the topics covered in these podcasts can be found at my webpage. Visit georgemonahan.com and follow the podcast link. You can also like the Age of Discovery and Conquest podcast on Facebook. If you've enjoyed this inaugural episode, please tell your friends. More episodes will be coming soon. In the meantime, I want to thank you very much for listening. I am George Monahan, and until we cross paths again, I wish you all the best.